Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
Sophie Evanoff is in the studio here. She is the force behind Vanille Patisserie, and the force is getting greater. Sophie, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So we met because we were... I was the MC of the James Tyree event earlier this spring, right? You were one of the judges.
I was one of the judges.
And you won last year.
I did.
The first female winner, and you paved the way, right? Because this year's winner was female.
Another
as well.
Female, yeah.
How did that award, winning that, how big of an impact has that had on you the last year?
It's been huge. I mean, with the award comes a $50,000 prize that's sponsored by Mesereau Financial and the private bank. So with that money, we were able to offer health benefits for the team. And we also are implementing a brand new POS system that's designed just for bakeries.
I like that you had that influx in cash and you didn't look at expanding or whatever. You looked kind of inward and spent it on your employees.
Correct. Yeah, it's important to take care of your team.
And now you're getting bigger, right?
We are
heading
getting bigger.
To the south side. This would be the fourth store?
Number four. We're opening another location in Hyde Park in Harper Court.
And is that right on the campus of the University of Chicago?
Yep, right in Harper Court.
I got ahead of us a little bit, but obviously the name of the place, Vanille Patisserie. So we're thinking of French desserts. What else do you offer?
We just launched a new catering line, 2 months ago. We started doing gourmet lunch boxes geared towards corporate catering. So we're very excited. That's only through our catering, not in our stores.
So someone has a business meeting or something like that,
Correct.
You deliver the lunches.
Right.
Typical, like peanut butter and jelly, bologna,
that
kind of stuff.
That's what French are known for, right?
Right.
We have two vegetarian options and then two meat options, and we kept it limited because we wanted to execute everything really well.
I was going to say, I didn't hear too much about this. Did you bring it out quietly?
We did, yes.
And why is that?
We want to get our feet wet. It's a brand new area for us. Lunchboxes and savory food is not my forte.
Right.
So, you know, with anything, we want to make sure all the kinks are out, and, you know, we've had several orders, and everything's been rocking and rolling.
And the kinks have been out?
The kinks are out.
Okay, let's go to the south side. Is it different to... Do you have a different clientele there when it comes to being on a campus as opposed to a neighborhood with people walking by?
Yeah, I think every neighborhood has a little, you know, obviously different demographics, and we cater to that once we, you know, get our feet wet and we know what they
once
like.
Once you figure it out, right?
Yes.
So you don't go in thinking, I know this.
Yeah, never.
Right, okay.
You know, we let the neighborhood tell us what they want and what they're looking for.
Right, and I'm interested, we were talking off the air because, you know, so many parents want what's right. Every parent, I would think, wants what's right for their kids. You, early on, you used to skip school to make cookies. What's that about?
I did. Early on, I had a love of pastry and baking.
Yeah.
And my mom would let me skip school to go bake with the ladies
That's
at church
nice.
And bake with her.
And when it came time for choosing an area of study, though, they wanted you to do something different.
Correct. They were all for a nice college education and not a pastry school, not a trade school.
And so you, of course?
Of course, went to college. Changed my major every year. It took about 8 years.
Did you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? So you really never did settle in at college?
No.
Because this was always the thing.
Right. It was never what I wanted.
And so did you always know this was going to be where you were in a way?
I did.
Yeah.
And I don't regret making those choices because, you know, every
going
step of the way,
that, yep, yeah,
makes you who you are.
You're working. I know you worked at a commercial kitchen. You worked at a few places. And then Vanille Patisserie became available.
Correct.
You had a teacher who ran it.
Yes.
And it was approaching bankruptcy.
Yes.
You're 29 years old. And then you jump in. I can't imagine what your dad said then.
Yeah. He was very supportive. So since then, I think he thought it was a very small risk at the time. So he didn't think too much of it. But he didn't know that I had bigger dreams to grow it.
And so here you are opening up store number four. And what are the next dreams?
I would like one more in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then to really, you know, make this a national brand. And then I have some other goals.
Well, Sharon, I'm listening. We're all good.
We're going to use Vinny as a platform, and we'll get into some other areas. But...
Okay, one more than on the south side. You're going to open up there in the fall, probably.
Yes.
How long will it take before you know if it's going to work there? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know what? I don't worry about that, to be honest, because when you focus on that, then that's what happens.
Oh, really?
So I know we're going to be successful, and it's going to be a great location, and, you know, the neighborhood is really excited for us.
Well, it's great to see you again. I'm glad you came in. I'm sorry
we were
a little short.
No worries.
Information again for people who might want to check out this catering.
You can go to our website, vanillepatisserie.com.
Throw in a couple of L's in that vanille for those who don't speak.
Yeah. Right?
Nice to see you.
You too.
Bill Geiger is as well. Our regular conversations with Bill Geiger are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Nice to be here, sir.
All right, so, you know, we talk about being prepared for when things keep going down or when they go down, but things keep going up, right? This market is in a sort of a 9-year run.
Set a new record yesterday, and it's up to new record today.
And so I would imagine you're here to tell me that that's not going to last forever.
Well, not necessarily. Well, of course, it's not going to last forever,
okay.
Right? We know at some point it's going to drop. Anybody who tells you that they know when that's going to happen is wrong.
Is there a way? I mean, is there no way to predict? I mean, can you look for signs?
No, not really. The key is while it's going up, while you have the opportunity to really take control of your portfolio. I mean, you really should know what you own, what's in your portfolio. You need to know how much risk you have, and you want to make sure that you're kind of sort of doing what you should be doing for this stage of your life.
Well, I would imagine there's a temptation if you are in the market and the market continues to do well to try to stay aggressive as long as you can, but that can come with a risk.
Yeah, and there's a misconception that you have to stay aggressive to make money, and you don't. That trade-off is not concrete. You can protect yourself and still make very, very good in the money. The key is you have to take control. If you're, especially, Steve, if you're in your late 50s to early 60s, you need to take control of how much risk is in your portfolio. You can do that right now.
Right.
You can make sure that you don't have crazy risk. Right now, you can take part of your portfolio and create income with it. And if you can do that, you're going to reduce your risk and still be doing well.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, the final thing is I would say is also at this time of your life, late 50s, early 60s, another way to take control is just to make sure you don't have big losses at this stage of your life, because you can't, you don't have time to recover
right.
from them.
And so that's kind of what we're talking about, figuring out a way to create income from your savings, but also not put yourself at risk to where you lose what you need to retire.
Income is the ultimate control. If I told you today that you had more income coming in than what you're spending right now for the rest of your life, how much in control would you feel?
I'd feel pretty good.
You'd feel pretty good.
I might not finish the show, Bill.
you and I both will leave together.
Right.
But that's what you have to do. You want to pre-retirement. You want to restructure your portfolio so you're going to be able to create sustainable, dependable income to go along with your Social Security, that you've got more coming in than what you need.
All right, tell me a little bit how you do that. How is it that you create income?
There's a number of different strategies. We use one that creates dependable, sustainable income, and the asset value, your actual value of your account, continues to grow too. And it can grow 6, 7, 8% while you're creating the income source.
Hi.
You know, I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment, Steve, but we'll do something special for our listeners today. The next 5 callers who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, I'm going to sit down with them personally and help them create a retirement plan, a retirement portfolio that's consistent with late 50s, early 60s. So they're going to be ready. So we're going to do that on a complimentary basis, and I'll sit down with them personally.
And that personal part is a key part of it, isn't it? That you can see where they are, where they want to be, what they need, and all of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's completely personalized because everybody's different.
Bill Geiger, great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Great to see you, sir.
Elise Glink will be in the studio a little bit later on the program. We'll talk about real estate. You know, we tend to fall into real estate with Elise. Even sometimes we set out to talk about other things and we end up talking about real estate. But there was a study I saw, I think it was a Harris poll, about the top regret that homeowners have about their home. What do you think that would be? What do you think would be the top regret that homeowners have about their home? Ian Schur is a writer, editor at CNET.com. He joins us now on the Business Lunch. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. Did I wake you up there a little bit? You seemed like you were startled.
No, not at all. I was trying to think about I would love to have the problem of having a regret about being a homeowner.
Well, there was
in San Francisco. We don't have that opportunity very easily anymore.
It's all renting. Well, there was the same study looked at renters, and I think it was that they didn't save enough to buy a home, or they didn't live where they could afford a home. So I guess that's it. But for homeowners, yeah, their number one homeowners number one regret was that they didn't buy a house that was big enough, which is
So our problem, we have a, as you know, we have a 14-month-old,
yeah,
and we're in a one bedroom. So our biggest, I bring this up all the time whenever my wife and I are talking about this. We should have gotten a two bedroom back when we first moved to the city. And so that at least we'd have enough room to grow into as we were preparing to buy a home.
Well, that's
so
legitimate.
As a renter.
That's a real need for room. But I think a lot of the homes we live in are really way bigger than we need anyway. So, but that's coming up with Elise. Yeah. I want to talk to you about Pepe the Frog.
And one of the best hate symbols that have gone around the internet in a long time.
It's
right?
It's just an amazing story how this started as, you know, a cartoon zine, and it was okay. Let me tell the story, and you tell me if I'm right. Okay, so there's this,
sure,
you know, Pepe the Frog. You may or may not have known him, a kind of a cult figure. Everyone who knew it liked it. It was a favorite. Blah blah blah. It became mainstream. People like Katy Perry, Nicki Minaj started using memes of Pepe the Frog. That alienated his longtime cult following, so they created mean, evil Pepe the Frog memes. Those were picked up by the alt-right and by racist groups, and then all of a sudden you had the ADL listing Pepe the Frog as a sign of hatred. How did I do?
Yeah, you pretty much nailed it. Nice job. And the sad part about all of this, right, is that this is one of those situations where the original artist never, ever intended to have it become a hate symbol.
Nothing about Pepe, no way that Pepe was ever used was hateful, but it was just co-opted.
Right. Right, and so he feels like it's all been twisted, and then he has no control. So originally he decided to kill, quote-unquote, Pepe, and there's actually a strip that we have on CNET where Pepe is dead. And what he's trying to do now, he actually raised funds on Kickstarter to start a new zine about it, where Pepe, he's trying to reclaim Pepe as a status symbol for peace and for love and acceptance, basically the opposite of what he's seen on the internet as today.
So we'll Pepe,
see whether he's successful.
Yeah, so Pepe might have his second act in America. That's kind of the goal here.
Right. Well, you know, hopefully in the way that the artist originally intended as well, right?
And, I mean, so he's raising money. The money would be used to fund his zine, and then he's hoping that it would – I can imagine that this might be ripe for success because there are a lot of people pulling for him and want to bring Pepe back the right way, so they would spread a little Pepe love.
Well, and you have to imagine, like, for an artist, you know, this is – when you think about, like, what life is like as an artist, you're trying to express yourself and get, you know, to kind of – talk to the world in a different way. And when that completely gets twisted around, you have to imagine how emotionally frustrating that is.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why a lot of people are pulling for him, is that, you know, this, it's not just that this thing that he created became the symbol of awful anti-Semitic and racist and all of this stuff, but also that it never got to be what he intended it to be. And so hopefully he'll be able to do that. But it's a really fascinating example of how the internet can twist good meaning into an awful thing.
Yeah, it's a wild thing to watch. Keep us posted on it because I'm pulling for Pepe. Hey, you wrote a piece.
Absolutely.
You wrote a piece at CNET sort of about the same thing, about different ways to sort of strip hate from the internet. I don't know if that's an achievable goal, but there are a number of interesting things. So in your story, I know you know this, I'm telling everyone else, Twitter...
Yeah.
In the last 6 months of last year, in the last 6 months alone, shut down 376,000 accounts because of their extreme tweets on those accounts. That's a pretty phenomenal number, and that's what these companies are facing when it comes to try to wean out, I guess, the racist stuff, the anti-Semitic stuff, all the hateful stuff.
It feels like it's only getting worse, and that's why you see the tech industry starting to deal with this. You know, a lot of the tech industry used to kind of throw their hands up in the air and say, look, we can't control what people do with our technology. And that was okay back, you know, in court arguments about, you know, sharing music and stealing movies. But now that we're dealing with people actually getting hurt in the real world,
right,
and people getting harassed and people getting bomb threats and all sorts of stuff, the tech industry is finally coming to deal with this. And so there's some really fascinating stuff we wrote about, including one person, I think the most amazing one. They're trying to actually reinvent the internet. They're trying to create a whole new internet. And the way they think they'll succeed is that this time, everything you do is not anonymous. It's tied to you as a person. They think that'll keep you from being a jerk.
Is this the guy out of Austin?
Yes, exactly. It's called Authenticated Reality. And their website, of course, is called thenewinternet.com, right?
Okay. And how does that work then? You sign up for that. You have to use your own name. You have to authenticate your name before you get an account there. What does that mean?
Yeah. So, in fact, you have to use your driver's license. So they've worked with governments both in the United States and around the world to get to basically authenticate you through either your driver's license or your passport and to be able to say you are who you are. And then every time you log in, they make sure that you are the person you say you are and that you can't be anonymous, you can't steal other people's identity and all this stuff. And, you know, it's a very ambitious thing, right? We're not going to pretend that this is easy. The internet was hard enough to produce it in the first place, and it took 30 years between it being invented to us using it the way that we did for eBay and all that other stuff. So this is not going to be an easy thing to pull off. But if you can, it's going to be a really fascinating experiment.
That's just one of several examples that were put in the article by Ian Schur at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again. I hope we can do it again next week.
My pleasure.
Elise Glink is in the studio, publisher of ThinkGlink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. And, well, we've only got a few minutes, so I can't read all of your titles.
All right. It'll work this time.
Welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk mortgage rates. There was a study I just saw from Harris, and this is striking to me. They talked about homeowners and renters and things and what their regrets were. What do you think the number one regret is when it comes to homeowners in this country?
That they didn't buy sooner?
That they didn't buy bigger.
Bigger.
Yeah, and which is kind of sad, I think, in a way. You know, I think we should be going the other direction.
Well, it's sort of funny because the one thing that real estate agents will always tell a first-time home buyer is buy the biggest house that you can. And I'm always a little... Don't quite do that because you can really get yourself into trouble. It's usually if you're a first-time buyer, you're in your early 30s, you're kind of in that job trajectory, but you never know. And so when realtors tell people that, it's good advice, but you got to be careful and don't go overboard.
So I hear that from a different direction because when I would be in the market, I always felt like the realtors were showing me just beyond what I told them I wanted to purchase, right?
Because,
here's my window. And
they're like, yeah, well, you'll negotiate that price down right into your window, Steve.
And so I'm always thinking, well, they're just trying to make a bigger commission, but maybe they are trying to get me to buy as big of a house as I can.
Or both. Yes. And on that, they're trying to get a bigger commission. No, that generally is not the first thing they're thinking about. What they're thinking about is making you happy so that you refer all your friends to them. And so they won't do that if they're all out for the money.
Okay. So here it is from a different direction. And then a third one, maybe. I'm happy with the house that we bought. We bought our house 20 years ago.
Yep.
We bought it in Deerfield before the teardown mania and everything took off. And so had I purchased a starter home there, I don't think I could afford to stay there.
Yes.
Right? So I was better off to buy as much as I could when I did.
Yeah, you were. And my husband Sam and I did the same thing 24 years ago almost. We bought a house in Glencoe, a little teeny tiny teardown that my mother, the great real estate agent, said, really, this is what you're doing? And it was our second house, not our first. We lived in a co-op on Lakeshore Drive when we first got married. But we really spent just about every penny we could. But 5 years later, we had saved enough money to totally renovate the house.
Ah, okay.
And so one of the things that I think first-time buyers don't realize is that you can buy something small, but if it has potential to expand, you like where you're living, that's one of the ways you make an investment in your future.
That's one of the things, too. And, you know, I've slowed down. But I used to sort of consider, my wife and I had a house in Michigan for a while. We had a condo that we, in a way, redeveloped. So I always considered houses to be living things, that they weren't static. You know, you could make adjustments to them and really change the way they are.
Yeah, they're really some of the most creative things that you can do to a house, right? And to anything in the space that you live in. I mean, just changing the paint color, cheap thing to do, gives a whole new feel and texture and way of living in your house in some cases.
I want to, let's stop talking about my house, will we?
Should we? If you want. That seems to happen with me. It's like an occupational hazard.
I've got an attached screened-in porch, which we love, and then a deck. And I never use the deck. So my thing in my family now is I want to take the deck off and put a ground-level patio because those are big things. So that's kind of what I'm saying. You can always be changing things.
You can, and it seems funny to say this, but there are it's not seasonality really with the house, especially up here, but there are definitely phases that people go through. And right now what I'm seeing a lot in houses, the more modern look, which if you go to Pinterest, you'll see all over the place, are glass tiles for bathrooms, different colored granite, you know, other things than stainless steel, using mix-match cabinets in the kitchen, back to wood floors. So it's really interesting to watch.
So Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill this week, and I think she's back today, in fact, before the another committee. But interest rates have, where have they been? I mean, they haven't really, they've been up again recently?
Well, they've been below 4%. So what we've seen is Janet Yellen has raised interest rates, I think it's two times this year. There, she is looking to continue that. And yet in mortgage interest rates, which are based on the long-term bond or 10-year bonds, those have actually fallen a bit, but now they're going up. And so the end of the year, economists still tell me they're looking at 4.5% to 5% for mortgage interest rates. And but the realtors are already like, hey, things are dying. People aren't buying houses. The numbers are falling. And in fact, in this week's primary mortgage market survey from Freddie Mac, it looks like mortgage applications are down 7.5%.
5% interest rates are historically pretty low, but
ridiculously low.
But a good deal higher than where they are right now.
It's psychological. People are already buying to the maximum that they absolutely can. Home prices are going up. Once you start raising that lever of mortgage interest rates, affordability is just toast.
Well, okay. So should, if you're in the market right now, should you rush to get it done? Or big picture, half a percentage point isn't that, well, it is a big deal over 30 years.
It's a big deal over 30 years and over 15 years. It's not a big deal as your income rises over time, but it could mean the difference between buying a home and not finding anything that you like in the area you want to live in.
All right, let's talk junk for a while. Illinois has a budget.
Yeah, but it's slightly over junk now. I'm so excited.
Right, and we escaped the junk bond status. Is that a big deal for us?
Well, it means we're not quite as smelly anymore, but yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal because every time the state has to borrow money to meet the shortfall of the pension plans, we don't have to, you know, basically pay quite so much. The problem is that we're not actually dealing with the problem,
right,
which is that we need pension reform in this state. We need to have some growth. We need rich people to stop leaving, and we need to get our act together.
All right. Next week, you'll tell us how to do that.
Sure. I'll come up with a plan.
Elise Glink is the woman behind Best Money Moves. You should check it out. It's a software that helps workers deal with their financial stress, dial it down, right?
Yeah.
Head toward businesses that way. ThinkLink.com.
Yeah, absolutely. And BestMoneyMoves.com as well.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.